Hello and welcome to the World Nuclear News. I'm Alex Hunt, and in this episode we'll be having a look at the nuclear sector in India with Shah Nawaz Ahmed, and we'll be hearing World Nuclear Association Director General Sama Bilbao Leon's review of 2022 and her hopes for nuclear in 2023.
Now this is the time when we need to start to deliver on all these things that we've been promising or explaining for the last few years. So it is very important that we line up all the ducks in a row to make sure that all these projects and all these demonstration projects that are taking place in many countries in the world, whether they are large reactors, whether they are small modular reactors or even micro reactors, we really need to make sure that those projects are successful. And successful as in on time, on budget, and achieve the goals that we are promising. Because frankly, the global communities started to watch nuclear very closely, and we really need to show that what we are saying that this technology can do is actually being done.
But before all that, we're going to be focusing on uranium. We're being joined in a moment by John Champaglia of Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. But before then, here's World Nuclear News' Claire Maiden to set out the basics. Hi Claire. So for those who are not so sure about it, what is the role of uranium in the nuclear energy sector?
Uranium comes at the very start of the nuclear fuel cycle, Alex. I mean, it's a heavy metal element that's found in the Earth's crust at a concentration of about 2.7 parts per million. And that means it's just about as common as tin, and it's more abundant than gold or silver. It's present at low concentrations in seawater as well, and its slow radioactive decay is actually the main source of heat inside the Earth itself. Uranium was discovered in 1789 by German chemist Martin Klaproth from pitchblende samples from silver mines in Bavaria. And for 100 years or so, the main use of it was as a colourant for ceramic glazes and for tinting in early photography. But then, in 1898, the Curies discovered radium, which they isolated from pitchblende. Now, radium was very highly prized for therapeutic use. And in 1906, it apparently reached a price of something like $10 million per gram. But uranium itself was treated as a waste material from the production of radium. But all that changed with the discovery of nuclear fission in the 1930s and the emergence of the first civil nuclear power reactors in the 1950s. Now, of course, you don't just dig a lump of ore out of the ground and load it into a reactor core. First, the uranium needs to be extracted from the ore, a process called milling, and then it needs to be processed so that it can be enriched in the fissile uranium-235 isotope before being fabricated into nuclear fuel.
That's a history, but where is it found and mined?
Okay, so it's found in very low concentrations in pretty much all rocks, but the definitive reference on this is a publication called Uranium Resources Production and Demand, familiarly known as the Red Book, and that's been published jointly by the OECD Nuclear Energy Agency and the IAEA since 1965. It's now up to something like its 28th edition. Now, according to the latest edition of the Red Book, which was published in 2020, Australia has about 28% of the world's identified resources. That's resources recoverable at a cost of up to US$130 per kilogram. That's followed by Kazakhstan with 15%, and Canada has 9%. Russia has 8%, Namibia has 7%. In fact, Africa as a whole has something approaching 18% of world resources across five countries. More than a dozen countries produce uranium, although about two-thirds of world production today comes from mines in just three countries, Kazakhstan, Canada and Australia. In 2021, total world production was just over 48,000 tonnes of uranium, according to World Nuclear Association. Currently, world production is led by Kazakhstan, which produced about 45% of the world supply in 2021. But as well as uranium from mined ore, which we call primary sources, there are also secondary sources of supply. Now, this includes things such as stockpiles of uranium held by utilities and governments, material from decommissioned military warheads, material recovered from used fuel, anything that's not primary production from a mine.
And who mines it? Is it state-controlled entities or private businesses?
Well, uranium is mined pretty much like any other metals, although before it can start to be turned into fuel, it's first processed to make uranium oxide concentrate, U308, also widely referred to as yellow cake. This is usually done at or near the mine site by the mine owner or operator, although in some instances ore might be toll milled at facilities belonging to a different uranium company. The companies themselves include publicly traded companies like Cameco from Canada and state-owned companies. For example, Orano is majority owned by the French state.
So how has the uranium market varied over the years?
Well, World Nuclear Association and its predecessor, the Uranium Institute, they've been following the uranium market trends for decades, producing a biennial fuel report since the 1970s. The most recent one was published in September 2021. Like all mineral commodity markets, the uranium market tends to be cyclical, with prices that fluctuate, basically down to demand and perceptions of scarcity. The earliest uranium production went into military inventories, and from the mid-40s to the late 1980s, supply did exceed reactor requirements. So that surplus production basically became the stockpile supporting those secondary sources of supply I mentioned a few minutes ago. Now, these secondary sources made up shortfall in primary supply from mines since the mid-1980s onwards. In the uranium market, however, high prices in the late 1970s gave way to depressed prices in the whole of the period from the 80s and through the 90s, with spot prices that were well below the cost of production for all but the lowest cost mines. And then, of course, we had Fukushima and the knock-on effects from that on the supply and demand situation, with countries changing plans for nuclear, such as Germany, and of course Japan's reactors being taken offline for quite a long period of time. And the market was in basically a situation of oversupply, and uranium mines were being mothballed or producers were cutting production. The two biggest commercial producers, Cameco and Kazatomprom, have both pursued strategies to discipline their production over recent years. But then over the last couple of years, we've seen the emergence of a different sort of market player that's been buying physical stocks of uranium for investment purposes. So we've had now find ourselves in a situation with declining inventories that support those secondary supplies I mentioned, coupled with recent geopolitical issues, which have raised questions about the importance of security of supply of all sorts of energy sources and diversity of sources, not to mention the drive for net zero, prompting a consideration of an even greater role for nuclear energy. And all these play into the demand and supply question for uranium.
To discuss the issue further, we're joined now by John Ciampaglia, CEO of Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. Hello and welcome, John. To start off, can you tell us a little bit about your background and the trust?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great to be on for the first time. Well, it's been a very interesting journey, to say the least. We started getting interested in uranium back in 2018. At that point, the market was incredibly dislocated and was obviously going through a very challenging period where mines were being put on care and maintenance. But if you tried to look past all of that gloom and doom, we saw a silver lining. And that silver lining was a form of energy production that we thought was not going away. We thought it had a role to play in terms of our energy mix. Maybe I'm biased because I live in the province of Ontario and we're often pointed to as a leader in nuclear energy. I grew up not that far away from the Pickering Power Plant, so it's something I was accustomed to having in my neighborhood. And our thesis was that the market would eventually find an equilibrium to get back into a place that would ensure long-term security of supply. And I think we were obviously a little early with that thesis, but I think it's clearly playing out now.
So how exactly does it work then when you say that you've invested in the sector?
Yeah, so we entered the market by acquiring a long-standing vehicle, which was called Uranium Participation Corp. That vehicle had launched on the Toronto Stock Exchange in 2005. In July of 2021, we acquired that vehicle and reorganized it into an investment trust. And so that was our first sizable investment in the sector. We essentially modernized the structure to be more transparent. We wanted the vehicle to be as shareholder-friendly as possible. So in addition to providing a nightly net asset value, we disclose to the world, you know, what we're doing in the uranium market in terms of our acquisition of additional material. We also implemented a capital raising tool called an at-the-market offering, which is very shareholder responsive, meaning when a shareholder would like to participate in the trust, if the trust is trading at a premium to its NAV, we have the ability to issue new units into the trust. And that's how we've been able to grow the vehicle from around $600 million when we acquired it to just under $3 billion today. Obviously, the price of uranium has gone up from the high 20s per pound to around $48 as of today. But we've seen significant institutional inflows. The second investment we made was through an acquisition of a uranium mining ETF, which has now been rebranded the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF. It trades on the New York Stock Exchange, and that holds a basket of all the key producers, developers, exploration companies. And we feel that one of the ways that the sector needs to get back into balance is through a pretty significant recapitalization of the sector following, as you know, a multi-year bear market. So the industry needs capital. The industry needs capital to develop the mines of tomorrow, to find the new mines of tomorrow. It's an expensive undertaking. It's very capital intense.
What's 2022 been like for the uranium market? What have been the biggest impacts on it? And what has been the impact of events in Ukraine?
Yeah, well, 2022 has been an absolute roller coaster year for most markets, particularly in energy commodities. You know, we saw the price of uranium go from $42 in January up to $53 in kind of April. And then we saw a $10 increase in a very short period of time on the back of speculation that we could see sanctions against Russian uranium and uranium-related services. That speculation is clearly dissipated and the price has kind of moved down in tandem. But if you look at the prices for conversion and enriched uranium, you know, they have had significant impacts in 2022, namely because Russia controls, you know, meaningful parts of global capacity in those two particular services. So we've seen the price of conversion and enriched uranium go up significantly this year. The price of natural uranium has not had a big dramatic spike like the other two have, but we think it is only a matter of time before that pricing pressure trickles down to the initial feedstock, which is uranium. While we've seen a supply response in the market at $50 or $60, that's only been, you know, kind of tier one assets coming back from being on care and maintenance. If you move beyond tier one assets, which already have sunk costs, bringing on any kind of new production, greenfield production, is going to require significantly higher costs, because if you look at the cost estimates to build new mines, and you know, at Sprott, we're very involved in the mining sector, they have exploded. And so, you know, as a new uranium mine, you're not going to be able to get the requisite financing at $50. You're going to need, I think, prices of at least $70 or higher, depending on what part of the world your mine is located, what type of mine it is, et cetera. So that's the bullish thesis that we see playing out over time.
So what do you see as the main factor? Is it geopolitical factors, or is it just a rise in nuclear energy plants around the world?
Western governments, for the most part, have essentially been very neglectful of nuclear energy for the greater part of the last 10 years. This is changing dramatically because of two reasons. One, growing realization that nuclear energy has to be part of the energy mix. Otherwise, no one is going to meet any of their decarbonization goals. We've added a tremendous amount of investments and incentives to build out renewables, which has been, you know, a positive step in terms of decarbonizing our grids. But it comes with a trade-off, and that trade-off is intermittency and weather events. And we've seen more and more issues, whether you're in the UK or Texas or where have you, where renewables are just not as reliable as we need them to be. And so nuclear is the perfect complement in terms of that baseload power. So I think as governments are finally taking nuclear out of the penalty box and just simply putting on a level playing field with other types of energy, it's giving confidence to the sector to make long-term investments again, to make significant capital investments. And, you know, we're seeing an immediate impact as your plant gets a life extension, or it's able to more effectively compete against the renewables, or natural gas power plants. These plants are able to compete more effectively, and that means they can operate longer and they need more fuel. And so that's why I think we see utilities coming back to market and probably signing the most new contracts in 2022 that we've seen in probably 10 years. So we think that's a very healthy sign that the industry is coming back to life. And then finally, you know, energy security, which is a term we haven't really talked about for a very long time, unfortunately, is becoming part of our daily narrative right now as the price of natural gas and coal and LNG have absolutely gone crazy at times over the year because of the delicate balance that we have in global energy systems. And when you upset that balance, it can have a very immediate impact. So I talk a lot about how nuclear power plants are the perfect offset to mitigate some of those risks related to running different types of power plants, just because of the pure density of uranium and the fuel and the energy it can provide. You're just not at the mercy of, let's say, you know, a supply shock like the natural gas market has gone through this year.
One thing I was going to ask was that over the last few, very recent few years since Sprott came on the market, you know, we've seen quite a change with players such as yourselves buying physical uranium when the market was in oversupply. I'm kind of interested to know how you see Sprott's role and the players who are buying the physical uranium going forward over the coming few years.
Yeah, sure. So look, our vehicle is a passive vehicle, meaning if investors want to participate in the physical uranium market, I mean, obviously it's very challenging to do that on a direct basis. So the vehicle is designed to allow investors to express their interest in the physical commodity. If the fund trades at a premium to its NAV, that gives us the ability to issue new units, that those units provide the trust with cash, and that cash is then deployed out into the spot uranium market, where we've acquired approximately 40 million pounds of U308 over the last 16 months or so. So it's really an expression of what investors want to do. The vehicle is there to respond to their needs. And I still think that the sector, from an investment perspective, is still relatively unknown, understood, and not crowded. Meaning, it's not uncommon for me to have an introductory call with a very large investment management company that could be managing tens of billions of dollars that is literally asking me to do the Uranium 101 conversation. Really, since COP26, that seemed to be the turning point where everything just started to fall into place. The narrative, the story, the support, the energy policy. A lot of investors that we talk to, they are interested in the energy markets because, you know, energy is a critical part of our economy and our day-to-day lives. Some of them are trying to transition away from oil and gas. So they're looking for cleaner ways to stay within the energy sector. And we talk to a lot of funds that are putting nuclear energy within their energy transition funds or sleeves within larger funds. So I think it's really great to see that nuclear energy is being put in this narrative of energy transition. And I think if I was working at a utility with nuclear power plants, I think that's great, because I often say that there's a lot of misunderstanding and misconceptions about nuclear energy. So it's all about education and trying to explain to people, you know, facts and science. There's also obviously a very long perception of nuclear energy being unsafe. And I was recently marketing in New York with an analyst that's been covering the sector for 15 years, and that the perception of investors would be oil bad, coal worse, nuclear the worst. And he literally said you just couldn't even talk to people about it. And so the fact that it's now being included as a solution for energy transition and energy security, I think, is a very powerful driver of, and it's what is reigniting interest in the sector. And I think it's very healthy.
What are you going to do with all the uranium you're buying, John?
Yeah, I often get asked that question. Well, right now we just, you know, we're sitting on it. It's a stockpile. It's a perpetual product, so it doesn't have a finite life. We don't want the fund to be a secondary supply overhang, because the reality is we've just finished working through a multi-year process to clear that overhang. What we don't want to do is obviously have that material come out to the market and depress the price. That's obviously not what our investors want us to do. And the material will be there. We often get asked, like, does it make sense to be doing this? And, you know, the reality is that there are financial intermediaries and speculators in every other commodity market in the world. So we don't think uranium should be any different. And at the end of the day, the market, it's a free market, and market participants help set it. So we think we've brought a lot of price discovery and transparency and liquidity to the market.
Looking ahead to the next decade or so, and we've got other changes that are coming up, like advanced reactors that are going to require new types of fuel, like HALEU fuel. And been announcements recently that the Department of Energy in the US is working hard to establish a domestic commercial HALEU production supply chain. What impact do you think these sort of developments over the next 10 years or so are going to have on the uranium market?
Yeah, I think they're going to have tremendously positive impacts. I think there's so many positive news developments happening around the world that are supporting nuclear. I mean, in Darlington, which is also in my province of Ontario, they just broke ground on the SMR there. And, you know, whether you're in Canada or the US or the UK or Japan or South Korea, I mean, everybody wants to be involved in this SMR race. And it's obviously still to be determined how successful it is. But I personally think this is, it's hugely exciting, because I do think it's another tool in the box for nuclear. I think this is going to be hugely interesting over the next 10 to 20 years as these technologies are approved, commercialized, developed, deployed. I think it could be a real game changer. And, you know, I think no one's even really thought about the fuel needs until more recently. Many of the demand models that I look at for uranium have absolutely zero inclusion for demand coming from SMRs. And obviously, the type of fuel that we need for SMRs are very different, which brings up another big picture issue, which is, you know, we've essentially offshored a lot of these services to other countries, and we need to reshore, whether it's uranium mining needs to be reshored, whether it's uranium services and, you know, fuel for advanced reactors. All of these things need to be reshored so that our supply chains are more secure. And I think you're seeing policy address that. The Department of Energy is obviously, this is very top of mind for them, asking for significant funding to ensure a smooth transition, looking for funding to rebuild a strategic reserve of uranium, as well as the HALEU fuel. So we think that people in the industry and policymakers are clearly signaling that they are concerned about the supply chain long term. And we think the right announcements are being made. So one thing I often tell people about this industry is it moves in glacial terms, but once it starts moving, it's hard to stop. And I think the glacier is moving right now.
I think we can see that you're looking forward to 2023 and a good year ahead for the nuclear industry. John, it's been great to speak to you, and many thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
But now, with a new year beginning, I'm delighted to be joined by World Nuclear Association Director General Sama Bilbao-Ilion, who considers the nuclear sector's 2022 and then looks ahead at her hopes for 2023 and what the key developments are to watch out for. Hi, Sama. It's great to have you back on the podcast. How would you assess 2022 in terms of the nuclear energy sector?
Hi, Alex. It is a pleasure to be here. It's a very, very, very nice way to start the year. So 2022, I would say that it was a very important year for the global nuclear industry. I think that the narrative changed quite significantly last year. And obviously, we saw that clearly at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. I think that the global policymakers, the global finance community, and really the average person out there are starting very clearly to recognize the very important role that nuclear energy has today and has had obviously for several decades. But also they are starting to recognize how nuclear energy is absolutely essential as we move forward for the clean energy systems of the future. So that really has been a tipping point, and that is going to be very important for us in this year and moving forward in the nuclear industry. So last year we had very, very important things that happened that definitely changed or impacted how we did our everyday work. Obviously, the war in Ukraine has been an enormous determinant of how we do our work. Clearly, it's been very important for us in the association, but for the world everywhere, to understand what is happening in Ukraine, in particular, in our case, for the nuclear units in Ukraine. So, of course, that determined a lot of the work that we did last year, and of course, we will continue doing this year in terms of our ongoing collaboration with the International Atomic Energy Agency and with the World Association of Nuclear Operators. So that was huge, constant cooperation last year, and we will continue to do that. So that is very important. But then, I mean, last year also was my first in-person symposium. I mean, actually, my first ever symposium as World Nuclear Association Director General. So that was a highlight because it was the first time that the global nuclear industry got back together. I thought it was a fabulous event. The feedback that we received from everybody that participated was incredibly positive. And I really thought that there was such a enormous amount of energy and enthusiasm. Everybody saw the importance of the historical moment that we are living for the global nuclear industry, and everybody started to lay out their plans to make the most of this opportunity that we have in front of us. Also, from the financial point of view, last year, finally, the saga of the EU taxonomy reached an end that was positive for nuclear. So we did see the enactment of the Complementary Delegated Act that does recognize nuclear energy as a sustainable investable asset. So that was enormously important. Obviously, much work needs to be done in that area, which we will continue to do this year. But obviously, not only in Europe, but at a global level. So all in all, I think it was a very good year that sets the stage for positive developments in nuclear. But as I said, a lot of work needs to be done. Then one thing that I will say, 2022 was a year where the strategic importance of nuclear energy for energy independence and energy security was highlighted. And obviously that did result in even policy changes in some countries, including Germany. So that brought a lot of visibility to that dimension of nuclear. And then something that, I mean, to me is very important, I know that for many of our listeners is also very important, is this third dimension of the energy trilemma that perhaps has been not so highlighted, but because we had COP in Africa, it actually took a little bit of more visibility. And it's the equity leg, if you wish, of the energy trilemma. It is very important to recognize, while for many developed countries, decarbonization and making the most of the current energy sources is very important, for the global south, I mean Africa in particular, but not only Africa, many countries in Southeast Asia, in Central and South America, when we talk about the energy transition, for them, it's a transition from no energy to energy. So that dimension is very important, and I think that many of those countries started to look very seriously at how nuclear can afford them abundant, clean, cost-effective 24/7 energy.
So as 2023 gets underway, what are your expectations and hopes for the industry for the year ahead?
The very first thing that I would like to see is peace in Europe. We will continue to work together with the International Atomic Energy Agency and WANO to ensure that the units in Ukraine operate safely, and just as importantly, that all our colleagues, the nuclear professionals that are making sure that these units are operating safely and effectively, well, they are themselves safe and able to perform their work and their job in a way that is what it needs to be, not the current very impossible conditions that they are facing. now in 2023, we have lots and lots of work to do. What is important for us that we are reaching the level of visibility and the level of acknowledgement from policymakers and the financial industry. Now, this is the time when we need to start to deliver on all these things that we've been promising or explaining for the last few years. So it is very important that we line up all the ducks in a row to make sure that all these projects and all these demonstration projects that are taking place in many countries in the world, whether they are large reactors, whether they are small modular reactors or even micro reactors, we really need to make sure that those projects are successful, and successful as in on time, on budget, and achieve the goals that we are promising. Because frankly, the global communities started to watch nuclear very closely, and we really need to show that what we are saying that this technology can do is actually being done. So for me, to actually make sure that we are delivering on those things is very important. And then, what I think is very important also is that from now until the time when these projects are going to be online, which is going to be the later half of the 2020s or even early 2030s, we need to do a lot of work. So number one, in my mind, is we need to continue to work with policymakers to make sure that we put in place bold, ambitious, technology-neutral policies that do recognize the role of nuclear energy. And as you know, in our side, World Nuclear Association is doing quite a lot of work with it, whether that is in the context of the UNEC group of nations, also with the ASEAN group of nations, and even now with the African Union. So that is very ambitious, but essential, because if the policies and the markets are in there, it's going to be very difficult to incentivize investment, both in the projects themselves, but also on the supply chain. That is going to be essential to support the on-time delivery of all those projects. So that would be the first thing. The second thing that is very essential, and of course in this area I would say that World Nuclear Association, we are pioneers, is the area of the streamlining of licensing and regulatory frameworks. So as you know, we've been working on this for probably 15 years, and we are very glad that already last year this important aspect was recognized even by the International Atomic Energy Agency with the NHSI initiative, the Nuclear Harmonization and Standardization Initiative. So we are working incredibly closely together with the IAEA to make sure that we bring all our expertise and all our knowledge and all our lessons learned from 15 plus years to this NHSI initiative. But on our side, we are also doing quite a lot of work that is complementary and supportive of this other work that the agency is doing. So again, it's essential that we put in place everything that is needed to really accelerate and optimize the way we regulate and license nuclear reactors. Obviously, this is particularly important for SMRs, but it really is important for all reactors at an international licensing level. And then, last but not least, is what I was telling you earlier, finance. Much work has been done last year and before on making sure that the finance community understands the role of nuclear, but much more work is needed. And this is one of our strategic priorities within the work that we are doing in World Nuclear Association. We've been working quite closely with standard-setting organizations, international standard-setting organizations that are setting the standards for ESG, for sustainable reporting, for sustainable taxonomies. So that is an area where we are building on the work that we've been doing at the European Union level for the EU taxonomy, but obviously the entire world is working on that area. So yeah, lots of work, but also very promising, because again, the tides are turning a little bit. So yes, very busy year ahead of us.
it sounds like it's going to be a busy year ahead. I look forward to going back over it in a year's time. Many thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Always at your disposal.
I'm delighted now to be joined by Shah Nawaz Ahmed, Senior Advisor, India, Middle East and Southeast Asia for World Nuclear Association, to discuss the nuclear energy sector in India. Hello and many thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Alex, for having me here.
To start with, can you give us a brief outline of the history of the nuclear energy industry in India, please?
Well, I think India nuclear industry has a very interesting prehistory. India gained independence in 1947. But the interim government, led by Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, actually established the Atomic Energy Committee in 1945. And the commission was established in 1948. So you can say that within the first year of India's independence, the nuclear power program had been initiated. And even today in India, Dr. Homi Jahangir Bhabha, who was the first chairman, holds a very iconic place, not only in the scientific sector, but nationally. For he visualized what still remains India's primary program, that is the three-stage program, of utilizing the ample amount of thorium available in the country for energy independence. This was visualized before the first uranium commercial reactor went into operation. So I think India was lucky to have two people working together who could think long-term when energy independence perhaps was not even a political issue. So I feel that it was something sort of a miracle that should have happened so early in India's independence.
So this time it was all about nuclear energy rather than weapons?
No, I don't think the program began as a strategic program at all. Because if you see, the first research reactor was built with what we call international cooperation, Apsara, in 1956. And the first power reactor was built in 1969 with the what we call US GE collaboration. And these collaborations would not have occurred if anyone had a doubt about India's intentions. So I do not think that at any point in time it was visualized, at least in the early days, that this would be done. Of course, one could interpret it depending upon one's political views, because Bhabha always stressed on recycling, because without extracting plutonium, you cannot build a thorium reactor. So the path of thermal reactors to fast reactors to thorium reactors was always there. So some of these plants, downstream plants, were built fairly early. Yes, that's true.
So India were very early into nuclear energy.
Yeah, if you see, the present nuclear capability is only about 6,700 megawatts. It still involves 22 reactors. So you can imagine that the amount of work that has been done. And for various reasons, between 74 to 2008 virtually, India was developing this totally indigenously. So they worked on all aspects of nuclear power and a very, very comprehensive program, which involved right from materials to computers. And well, subsequent developments, I am not really competent to speak about, but it was clearly not the intention, as far as I understand and know, to have a strategic aspect to the initial part of the program.
How big is the nuclear energy industry in India at the moment? And how does it compare with other countries?
There are two aspects to this. One thing is the law requires that nuclear plants can only be built and operated by companies belonging to the federal government or the federal government itself. In India, we call it the central government. So essentially, all these programs are government programs. And as you know, government buying programs require that above a certain value, you can only go through public tenders. So this, in spite of the fact that the program may not look that big in terms of megawatts, for every equipment and system, you have more than one supplier. In fact, you may find that even for the reactor vessel, you have two or three suppliers. So in that sense, the spread is very wide. But yes, if you talk only in terms of what has come out as an output, then the result is that 6,700 megawatts that we have presently. But the fact that India can order fleet mode today, talking of 10 PHWRs at the same time, is an indication that we are talking of capabilities across a wide range of industries with a number of suppliers. So I would say the spread would be comparable to, I don't like comparisons of that sort, but you could say the only country I can think of in Europe is France.
Interesting. How developed is the indigenous nuclear industry and sector in India?
Well, again, here two points come in. As far as the PHWR program is concerned, the figures are 95% to 98% of the Indian content, from raw materials to the final product. So you can say it is very well developed, but it is developed on the PHWR program. On the imported program, that is, say, light water reactors, for instance, which are already being built through the Rosatom is building them. The large part of the work is done in India, but still major equipment and critical equipment are coming from abroad. And the similar thing will happen for all reactors. There was a philosophy at one time of 80-20-20-80. That is, in the first instance, in 80% in terms of cost. The reactor, first reactor could be 80% imported or foreign part, to the fourth reactor as 20% imported, 80%. But I believe as more reactors come, this content will progressively increase for all technologies.
So what is being developed at the moment?
I mean, if you take a step back and you see the impact of the atomic energy program, it has impacted, for instance, the Space Agency is an offshoot of the Department of Atomic Energy. There was a time when secretaries, three secretaries, energy secretaries, were people formerly from atomic energy, including the Secretary for Alternate Energy. So its impact, social and technical development impact, has been very huge, I should say. Then the Atomic Energy Establishment actually does work across many sectors. For instance, India's premier cancer research institute, the Tata Memorial Center, is administered by the Department of Atomic Energy. So in a sense, you can say that it is the grandfather of the nuclear sector. And now you're having other people growing in that sector. But critical equipment is still made by what you call units of the Department of Atomic Energy, like, for instance, fuel, heavy water. The uranium mined is by a vertical company under the Department of Atomic Energy. The reactors are built by the Nuclear Power Corporation. Thermal reactors is under the Department of Atomic Energy. The fast reactor is Bhavani is also under the Department of Atomic Energy. But then you have research centers, like, for instance, the Indira Gandhi Center for Atomic Research has been working on the fast breeder technology, including waste management, for instance. So the waste management is done by BRC, for instance.
And how many reactors are in the process of being commissioned in India?
India has 22 operating reactors just now, most of them PHWRs, two early boiling water reactors, 1969 Tarapur that I was saying, and two VVRs. The rest are all PHWRs. India has recently announced building of four more units in Kundakulam, which will be VVRs. It also has announced building of 10 700 megawatt PHWRs. And this will be in fleet mode. And before that, another four PHWRs are under construction. Then also, one fast breeder reactor has been built in Kalpakkam, in Tamil Nadu. And we call it the prototype fast breeder reactor because it is expected that this will be the standard reactor that more commercial reactors will be built. In addition to that, India has very recently announced sites for many imported reactors, which total about 31,000. So, Anish, you can say that this is part of that originally envisaged 63 megawatts of nuclear power, which was originally envisaged for the 2030s. Probably it will shift to 2040s when all the reactors come in.
So what proportion of India's electricity generation does nuclear account for at the moment?
It is under 3% just now. So yes, it has a long way to go, and its contribution at this stage, I think it's more in technology than in actual generation. But one reason for that low percentage, of course, is the megawatts itself, but also the rapid expansion of the renewables.
You've already mentioned opportunities for foreign suppliers in India, but how is India doing in terms of exports? Is that something that's being developed?
Well, yes, manufacturers have not gone out to sell nuclear-based equipment. There are several reasons for that. We are expecting that as the joint ventures come in, for reasons of economy and for reasons of capability, there will be joint ventures with other foreign manufacturers in India. And it is estimated at this point in time, if the costs continue to be low, it is expected that those JVs will be exporting reactors when the similar vendor requirements exist in other nations. So at this point, it is at a nascent stage. The law does permit it, but I think the capabilities have to be established for the industry.
On the nuclear energy side, is there much crossover with experts in neighbouring Pakistan or China?
Whatever sharing is done is through countries, through organisations like WANO. I had the privilege of working in WANO for several years, and I do know that when they used to meet, they used to exchange information. But at the formal level from one country to another, I don't think the exchanges are substantial. But these international organizations like WANO, like WNA do give the opportunity for these sort of exchanges. And of course, the IAEA.
What's the public opinion like on nuclear power?
I think on the whole, the public has been very supportive of nuclear power. So there's a tremendous amount of not only establishment, but public pride in some of these programs. And I think that has been the sustaining, the oxygen that is sustained and sort of. And if you see, for instance, in neighboring countries also it's like that. If you go to Bangladesh, there's a very substantial amount of pro-nuclear. I'm not sure about Pakistan because I've not had much interaction there. But I'm sure that the fact that they are building in Karachi, the largest city, obviously means that there is a consensus that the nuclear program is acceptable to the public. And I think for countries that are, let me put it most diplomatically, countries that are able to afford it can go for other solutions. Countries that can't afford will go for the cheapest solutions. Nuclear may not appear cheapest in the short term, but in the long term, I think people are reasonably convinced that it is there. So upfront capital may be an issue, but I think beyond that, I think it's more or less acceptable.
So what are likely to be the most exciting developments to watch out for over the next year or two?
Well, technologically, I think getting the fast breeder reactor program going and getting to the thermal reactors. Two designs have been made for the advanced heavy water reactor, both using natural uranium or using plutonium extracted from fast breeder reactors, and for LEUs from PWRs using the low-enriched uranium in PHWRs. They have not been built yet, but these designs have, at least one of those designs I know for sure, has gone through the regulatory process. In terms of business immediate, I would think that this 31,000 megawatts announcement is something that I cherished, and I find that since these will be imported reactors, the cooperation, international cooperation, international business can increase greatly. And if we are able to maintain the time schedule that is now being worked out, the revised time schedule, this should happen by the 2040s, 2030 middles, So it is not too far away. Some of the predictions are that it should be substantially higher, but we'll see the game as it goes along.
I'm looking forward to seeing how that pans out. Many thanks for your time, and I'm sure we'll be wanting to get you back for more of your expert analysis on the nuclear energy sector in India before too long. So thanks again.
Thank you very much, Alex, for having me, and it is a delight talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that is just about it for this month. Don't forget that you can find out more about all the subjects covered in our show notes, where you can also find links to sign up to our daily email briefings. And of course, do feel free to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts so you don't miss out on the next edition of the World Nuclear News.